Hi, welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, I'm a programmer at TIFF now, and this is the other thing I do. My guest this week is Paul Laverty, a veteran screenwriter whom you'll probably best know through his collaborations with the director Ken Loach, which started nearly 30 years ago with Carla's Song, and culminate in The Old Oak, a deeply empathetic drama about a dying mining town in the northeast of England and what happens when the British government starts sending Syrian refugees to live there because housing is really cheap. It's now playing in theaters across North America. In Toronto, we've just extended its run at the TIFF Lightbox, and it's also going to be Ken's final feature, so you should probably savor it. Paul picked The Golden Dream, the 2013 drama by Diego Quemada Diaz that follows three teenagers, two boys and a girl who's disguised herself as a boy, who embark on an epic train journey from Guatemala to the United States in search of brighter futures. It's not a new story, but Quemada Diaz finds an almost poetic register that immediately distinguishes his film from other migration stories, while never shying away from the danger awaiting his characters at every turn. It's intense and immediate and frequently beautiful, and it's almost been forgotten in the decade since its release. Paul thought we should do something about that. This is Someone Else's Movie.
It's not that I remember the film particularly well, Norm, but, you know, it's just when I was asked, it's one that just jumped out at me, and some of it's timing, I think, you know, but I just remember the sensations of it and the quality of it and the impact it had. You know, when I'm writing a script, I try not to, I mean, I don't really think of other films, to be honest, you know, and, well, not consciously, but when you ask me to name a film and to talk about it, you know, this is one that struck me very, very deeply. And maybe it's because I brought my kids to it. It was in a little film festival. And they were roughly the same age teenagers as the kids in the film. And there was something very pure about it, you know, which I thought was amazing. And you could tell, and Diego, I must declare an interest because Diego was an old friend, you know, from earlier films when he was a camera operator. So when I saw the film, it was absolutely, you know, gobsmacked. I was absolutely stunned because he's very modest and very quiet. And one thing is, you know, working in camera, but to, you know, direct and pull a film together, and it's a different beast. And I was absolutely knocked away with it. And quite apart from La Bestia, the train, that journey, just the cruelty of it, which is, you know, something that's repeated again and again and again. It's actually become, even since 2011, absolutely massive, you know. And I've just come back from the Balkan route in Europe. And this is people passing through the Balkans trying to get into Europe just now. And I went to a refugee camp there. And the stories you hear of absolute systematic cruelty and barbarity by the European authorities, paid for by European taxpayers, is absolutely mind-boggling. So I think it must have triggered something there. And then what I loved about the film too, really, I respected about it, you know, the ending was so politically astute. You know, it really was like a dagger between the ribs. There was nothing sentimental or nostalgic about it. And the last scene, which I won't give away to, you know, to people who might be listening, but I encourage them to watch, is a mighty payoff and massively insightful why we have this barbaric system. This is, you know, it serves a need, and you can see how it fits into the place of the grand politics that we have. And so for that, I thought it was a brilliant film. The ending, you know, there was no compromise, and it was so insightful. Right, so my great respect to Diego Quemada for his work there and his colleagues. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's all the more impressive to me that the film exists at all in the conversation so much later. You know, it was made in 2013, I think, and didn't even get released in the States until 2016. Or 2014, 2016, and it didn't play in Toronto until Latin American Festival. It didn't play TIFF or any of the usual routes. And I suspect a lot of that was because Cary Fukunaga's Sin Nombre had played 2 years earlier and been distributed by a major, by Focus Features through Universal. And it's the same story.
Well, I didn't see that one.
Yeah. Well, it's not as good. I think I can come right out and say that. The remarkable thing with The Golden Dream is that it's a film made by a cinematographer that is about heart. And Sin Nombre is a film made for cinematography. and it's very mechanical, and you know, it's concerned with the image and these lyrical shots of young men on an entire age range, because it's much more complex about the people on the train, but it is about the people riding the train into towards America from nation to nation through Latin America, and it is it's schematic and mechanical and contrived, and it feels like a studio version of a foreign film, you know, a quote unquote foreign film. We all know what that means, right?
Well, you hammered that one. You really nailed that one. I enjoyed that.
Thank you.
I really did. You really nailed that. I know exactly what you mean. It's funny you mentioned, you know, there was another wonderful DOP we worked with called Chris Menges.
Oh, sure.
And Chris, you know, Chris was an old friend of Ken Loach, who I've worked with for all these years, as you know, just so your audience know. And Chris Menges did the film Kes, and it was absolutely beautiful. But he went on to direct a film as well himself called World Apart, you know, based in South Africa. And that was a stunning film too. That really, really struck me deeply. I don't think the other ones were, you know, had the same reception, but World Apart and Chris's work on that was actually remarkable. And actually, strangely enough, he was the DOP on Route Irish, which we talked about many years ago.
Yeah,
a lovely, wonderful man, fantastic guy, and Ken said how much he learned from Chris, and how much they learned from the DOPs from the Czech Republic. You know, the masters there. You know, and how they use natural light. How they use kind of ordinary people to give life and flesh and blood to the story. Ken, one of Ken's favourite films was Closely Observed Trains, another cracker, a gentle comedy. So you can see the human touch in them. And funnily enough, I think Diego was watching Ken very carefully. So there's actually a continuity there, I think, which some of your listeners and viewers, you know, might find interesting if they get a chance to discover La Jaula de Oro, the golden dream.
That's my favorite thing about this podcast is finding the connections and just waiting to find out what my guest is going to pick is honestly the best bit, because it's almost always.
It just depends on your mood, doesn't it, really? And you're itchy in the moment and could have been one of many. But anyway, I'm glad we picked this one. I'm glad, because I think, you know, it might, you know, many people might not have heard of it. And I really do think it's worth having a look at again.
Absolutely. Well, and that's what I was saying about Sin Nombre, where the response of another distributor would probably be, oh, they just did that, and to ignore this film, and it just drifts along on its own. And it is so much more, I think, honest. It's more naturalistic. It's not concerned with the Golden Dream. It's not concerned with the reviews, although those will come. It's just telling the story that it's telling in the most quietly empathetic way. And the fact that the three principal characters are joined by a fourth who doesn't speak their language,
they manage
to understand each other anyway, that's the biggest leap of faith I think the film takes for the audience, that we will follow along and understand what everyone is doing and how everyone is relating.
And, you know, it's really strange, Norm, as well, because when I was in Serbia, you know, I just met so many young people traveling on their own. I mean, and the stories were just, I mean, like mind-boggling. You would not believe. But I think what happens is people on that journey, they just cling on to anything that will give them another possibility of survival. You know, I mean, I just met people that come up all the way from Africa, that crossed the Mediterranean, you know, crossed into Greece, crossed, many of them gone into Bulgaria, then into Serbia, and that's where I met them. And just the levels of violence and abuse and close shaves and what they'd witnessed. You know, there's a study done there by human rights researchers, and they found out that 90%, you know, had either witnessed or suffered, you know, in violence, you know, close up. Many of them had, you know, very, very close experiences. Many of the people I interviewed with had seen people who had been killed. You know, so when you talk to people who just kind of just going on from one place to the next, people on the move, you know, just the arbitrary nature of it and the fear of it and just the sheer sense of odyssey about it and what luck you need to get through it all. But the kind of the systematic cruelty of it all, this is what really, really got me, because there's always the smugglers who will take advantage. But what was remarkable about the people in this trip that I saw was just the systematic cruelty by the states in a planned fashion. You know, Greece just now has just been absolutely despicable. Bulgaria has been despicable. You know, just the level of violence used by the, you know, state organizations and personnel. You know, and it's kind of mind-boggling to think that this is just going on so much. And actually, just in preparation to speak to you, I just looked up the figures today. I think it's actually in the Wall Street Journal today, actually. I think 920,000 tried to cross last year from Mexico into the United States. You know, and but you know, the really smart question is, why are so many people on the move? You know, people always blame them for arriving there, but who would risk their? And the big thing, of course, families are on the move, and you only bring your children through the Darien Gap and up through Central America if you're absolutely desperate. And I think that really just raises enormous questions about how power operates, climate change, political corruption, who's arming many of these dictatorships where there's many people they're fleeing from. You know, so many, many, many complex questions. You know, and then and the wonderful thing about La Hora de Oro, it just personalizes it into three young kids, and you get a sense, you know, of some of the questions we've been talking about.
There is a sense, I think, in the media discourse about all of this, that no one wants to confront the fact that refugees are fleeing something, right? Yes. That they're the standard line in the US, and of course in the UK, and they're trying it here too in Canada, from the right, is that, you know, they're here to take our jobs. And that ignores the fact that there are jobs that cannot be done by Americans in America because they would have to pay them a living wage. Whereas if you're paying people under the table or you're courting immigrant labor, migrant labor, then you can cut all sorts of corners, including safety. And that's never covered. That's never explored. The thing that people are fleeing to is supposed to be the life that the reader of the New York Times has, which isn't how it works. It's not what's going to happen. I mean, you'll hear, you know, success story. Like to me, the most obscene immigrant success story these days is Elon Musk, who claims to, you know, started from nothing and come from South Africa and went to Canada for his schooling and then went to form his fortune in the state. He's got emerald money. He buys things. That's all it is. And but that's what people think of when they think of an immigrant success story, not someone who buys a chain, you know, like opens a franchise and buys a chain of laundromats after 25 years of working, that sort of thing. And that's the lottery. That's the lucky person who makes it through. And this is just for, you know, migration to America as an example, where if you're lucky, and the film does deal with the reality too, that not everyone will be lucky. The characters we see at the beginning don't all make it to the end. Sometimes because of bad luck, sometimes because of gender and bad luck. I mean, Sarah's whole story, I think the narrative that Sarah goes through would be its own feature now. Audiences are more open to stories of gender fluidity, and you know, there's a sense too that distributors and producers are more interested in making those films for the audience that's interested in them, which has been really rewarding as a programmer to see this surge in films about trans stories and just general queer stories. But this isn't that either. This is someone disguising herself to survive. And narratively, it's brilliant because it gives us a huge stake in her fortunes from the very beginning, because we know she has a secret that some other characters won't know right away. And that becomes its own narrative engine. But also, it's heartbreaking to see someone eradicate herself in order to start a new life, which is, I suppose, a different metaphor for the refugee experience, in that you are leaving everything behind and you don't know what's on the other side of this.
Yeah, I think those are all very good points, really. Very good.
Mm. Sorry, it was a lot.
No, not at all. It's lovely to have the exchange.
But the other thing about the film that I didn't want to let slide was the title, which in English is The Golden Dream, but in Spanish is The Golden Cage.
Yes.
So why do you think that was changed? I mean, I know you know the filmmaker. Did it ever come up? Have you ever discussed it?
Actually, I haven't seen Diego for so long, you know, and I've never, I mean, I wrote to him immediately after seeing the film, And I think I presented it at a few festivals because I was so struck by it. But funnily enough, we didn't talk about that, but it's a very good point as well. The Golden Cage, you know, maybe in the back of his mind, I'm just thinking just now, is, you know, I don't want to give the ending away, but, you know, when they do get there, you know, it's not really the land of freedom, really, that the people expect, isn't it? So I suspect it was something to do with that, you know, and I would imagine it's something that I'm going to actually write him now.
I would love to know the answer.
And maybe his answer is not, you know, the only answer, which is the lovely thing about, I think that's a lovely thing about, you know, when you make a film, really, you know, people make their own version of it. And that's the beauty of filmmaking. You tell a story and everybody will, you've just talked about it through, you know, the North American and the Canadian experience. Mm-hmm. You know, the references are Elon Musk and people that are, you know, dominating. I suppose he's a world figure now, but
yeah. But
someone else will see it, you know, from Spain or the UK or Scotland. We'll probably have different references, and that's the beauty of telling stories, isn't it? I'm always struck sometimes doing Q&As where people bring to the story, and that's the exciting bit, and that's respect for the audience too. When you leave them that space, you know, so that they can do that, and you know, and in a way, we always do the Q&As after a film. I always feel it's a pity because you need to let people settle and figure it out themselves, and you don't want to impose your narrative as the person who is on the other side of the story for so long onto that wonderful free imagination of the audience.
Yeah,
it's a funny old beast, isn't it?
It is. It's honestly so much fun to get involved with a Q&A that is not fully on the rails, where people do have differing opinions and the filmmaker either pushes back or does accept it, but still make sure that...
No, it's lovely because what's been lovely in these last couple of films that we've done, you know, we did The Old Oak, you know, Ken's last film we'll direct, but then we did Sorry We Missed You and I, Daniel Blake. We did these three films in the northeast of England. But there's a wonderful guy called Alex Hamilton. He won, and he's now with Studio Canal. But what he allowed us to do, and I've always had great, you know, I'll always be eternally grateful to him, is, you know, he's allowed community screenings. And so as the film is coming up to the end of its theatrical release, he'll allow community screenings. So people pay a nominal sum, then they can hire a church hall, a trade union, a university room. And with Daniel Blake, I think they organised about 600. It was all done at all, you know. And so there was all these amazing screenings going on. And then recently with The Old Oak, they did it again. And so some of the screenings I went to were amazing. And you know what was really remarkable though? Studio Canal did a poll, and many people had never been to a cinema in their life. Never been to, that blew me away.
Yeah.
You know, and it was mixed up with, you know, people who had been, people on the move, travellers, because of the, you know, especially Old Oak, they'd reached out to communities and people had recently arrived. I mean, they'd seen films, but on television or video or a phone or something, but they'd not been to the cinema. So to see it together, and then they organised it so that many of the immigrants in the local communities were also cooking. So we ate afterwards, and we ate and we had a discussion. And after The Old Oak, and honestly, some of the discussions, you know, this leads to just where you've brought me to, you know, in your question. Some of the question and the answers were just absolutely remarkable. And because many of them had been people on the move themselves, they just, you know, one of them, I remember this guy from, where was he from? I think he was from Guinea. I just was, but how did you make that? And he just kept saying, how did you do that? And he just couldn't get his head around that, you know, that, you know, I suppose Westerners had, you know, gone into that journey. You know, it was about Syrians and he was African. Didn't make a difference. And so then, of course, he talked about his own life. And then other people started chipping from elsewhere. And then there was an old boy from Syria, you know, that left. And he'd obviously got done up and he was in a beautiful suit. And I remember how his moustache was meticulously trimmed. And he tried to speak. And then he just wept. He just wept. You know, and he goes, that is my life. That is my life. And, you know, when you see kind of stories being a catalyst like that, it was kind of, you know, you could feel the hairs in the back of your head, you know, just hairs raising. You feel like storytelling was worth it, really. You know, and that exchange, you know, around that, it was in a wee local library. As we're all eating Syrian food, everybody chipping in. It was kind of chaotic, but wonderful, you know. and those types of screenings are just like, they're like gold dust, really. You'll always treasure them, really.
Hey, it's Norm interrupting my own show to bring you up to speed on Shiny Things, my newsletter about physical media, culture, and the Odd Streaming Project. Last week, I wrote about Ned Benson's long-awaited follow-up to his masterpiece, The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby, The Greatest Hits, which just dropped on Hulu and Disney+. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at shiny-things.ghost.io or find a link at the Semcast Blue Sky account. If you like reading about movies, I like writing about them. Come check it out. We screened a documentary about a beloved Canadian entertainer last year at the festival, Ernie Combs, Mr. Dress-Up. Everyone of a certain age knows this. It was so wonderful.
I love it. And that's the beauty. That's the beauty of watching something together.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we've really got to protect it. You know, we've had a catastrophe here in Edinburgh, that the Edinburgh Film House was closed.
I heard.
Festival and all that. But it looks like it's back on the road again and trying to get it up. But when you go, you realise what a hole it leaves in your life, you know? A place that you go to and watch cinema and, you know, but you watch it together and so many Q&As and questions there. So I really, really, I don't know how it is in Canada, but everything seems to be hanging by a thread in so many places, so many cinemas closing down. Yeah. But that communal experience of what you've just expressed, very, very special, really, you know, and so I really hope we can keep it going, really.
Oh yeah, it's my only wish right now is for people to reconnect to the idea of sitting quietly with other people and feeling something. And the three films that you were talking about, these last three films of Loach's, they're all about, I mean, all of the work you've done is about empathy, the films you've made together, but these three seem like a very specific attempt to address the state of Britain as things changed, like the Conservatives have been in power for quite some time, but it feels like with, you know, like when Trump came in America, something else was enabled in the Western soul, some kind of grasping, horrible thing that expresses itself by people not thinking that maybe they'll be shunned for saying something horrible and just enabling themselves to do it because the leaders are doing it. And you know, I, Daniel Blake is about a system that doesn't care about a sick man, but it's also about the incredible bonds that he forges in the last months of his life. And the food bank scene is the thing that I've been pointing people towards for years now, because it encapsulates this other thing, this assumption in the popular mind that people like migrants, like, you know, anyone characterized as not you, the reader, of the newspaper that you're reading, or the tabloid more likely, you know, they're othering people left and right. And this little tiny moment of a single mother just ripping into a can of peaches because it's the first thing she's eaten all day, and feeling shame for it and breaking down. That's not only, I mean, it's a virtuoso moment of storytelling and acting, but I've seen that film with audiences twice now. And it is the one moment where you can hear people choking up in the room, just like the rest of the film is a slow burn, but that moment just comes out of, like, just wallops you with it. And that's a better teaching tool than a 90-minute documentary on the same subject, you know, because it's all about understanding why it's happening and who these people are.
Yeah. And this is the good thing about, you know, when you're writing a script, you make up a story, but in a way you have to, especially a film like that, it was trying to get your head around the complexity the welfare legislation, because it's a minefield. And I used to be a lawyer way back, so it kind of gave me we knew there was something stinking underneath, but it's such a big beast. So the only way is to go around, and I used to go to the DWP, the Department of Work and Pensions, and talk to people going in, and you'd see them terrified. And I was going, this is remarkable. Then you talk to them, then you realize there are more rights for a parking ticket than cutting off your aid for an entire month to you and your whole family, which condemns your family to hunger. I mean, that's kind of remarkable. And then I suppose the big question that we kept asking ourselves at the beginning was this just a bureaucratic screw-up? So many people caught up in it. But then when you start digging down, you begin to realise the logic of it. And then I found whistleblowers. And the whistleblowers showed me the documents. And the government said, no, no, we haven't got, you know, targets for sanctions. Sanctions means the cut off your aid for those period. And then I found this wonderful whistleblower. And he showed me the names of all his workmates in his office, 35 of them, with a letter from the area manager saying only 3 had carried out enough sanctions this month. And if they didn't increase their sanctions, they'd be put on a PIP, this Orwellian language, a personal improvement plan. And if they were not put on that, they would lose their own jobs. And then the penny dropped, right? This is terrifying, people. It comes from the very, very top. It's a massive political leap. The numbers of sanctions went up by millions. And it was a choice by Cameron, that bastard Cameron, and Osborne, another bastard, who was the Chancellor of the Exchequer. And they made a collective decision to punish the poor, and they were used as a scapegoat. And then if people are scared and frightened, when they do get a job, they keep their head down, they don't join a trade union, and it's good to have the people scared and frightened and cowered. So it was actually systematic cruelty of a grand order on the back of a long tradition going back to Victorian times. The thing is, you've got to dig in underneath and see that, and then, you know, understand it, and then you can write it. Then you can forget, and you say, well, you could have told a story about people who have got mental health problems, or the old, or the young, or single mums, or whatever. But once you kind of done that work, you have all the options, you know, and then you have to simplify and tell the story. And there were much worse stories than Daniel Blake, you know, but Daniel Blake was the one that came to head when I was sitting in a cafe one day, and I just needed the name, you know, and it had to be a stubborn name, and I wanted a quintessential name. I remember the moment, my name is Daniel Blake, you know, and this idea that despite all that bureaucracy, he was still trying to maintain his dignity. He was a man who'd never asked for help in his life. You know, and I met people like that. I met wonderful people like that who were sanctioned. And it was barbaric. And it's happened to tens of thousands of people. It's a bit like this post office scandal here again. You know, people who are just totally, you know, just overtaken by this tidal wave of absolute cruelty. You know, and they've done it again. So it was a strange doing that. And then, sorry we missed you. We just felt we should look at working families. And then the Old Oak, we thought they were both tragedies in their own way. But for this last one, Norm, I suppose what we wanted to do was just examine the notion of hope, where it comes from, and how we nourish each other. You know, so when Ken said he was up for another script, it was the last 4 or 5 scripts, he's saying, well, I don't know if I'll have the strength to get around it, because he delegates nothing. And he is now 87. You know, and so to get through this last one after COVID and everything was remarkable. It was a remarkable feat of, you know, just physical stamina, but also courage for someone to dive in at that age to, you know, with the health problems that, you know, he's had, to dive in and do that. But it was his politics that got him through. But we wanted to look at that notion of hope. So for the people who do get a chance to see it, you know, that scene in the cathedral was very important to us. You know, that, you know, how do we, and I suppose the notion, again, looking back at the old traditions of the miners, you know, the miners in 1984, but that was also a very, very key moment in our political history. In 1984, post-industrialism, Thatcher and the state decided to absolutely defeat the miners. You know, the miners was the strongest trade union in the UK at the time. When the miners lost, then many of those communities were absolutely destroyed. There was deindustrialization. They just wrote places off. They didn't invest in them properly. And even to this day now, you see the marks of the 1984 strike in those communities. You know, and like we have in the film, you know, the libraries have all gone, the post offices have gone, the swimming, the infrastructure, even some of the churches, the community halls, the schools. And it's just kind of like a barbaric free market. And, you know, property prices have dropped down immensely once cohesive communities. So that's why they end up dumping refugees there, because you can buy a house there for £5,000. You know, £5,000, I mean, it's like people spend, you know, like 5 times more on a wedding than, you know, that in a house, you know. So and then you begin to see the logic of it. And so all these people were dumped out there, out of sight, out of mind. But the people who live there, and I suppose this is why we have to try and understand where all the anger for it comes from, you know, both here in the UK and in Trumplandia, you know. These post-industrial belts where people feel they've lost agency, in their own lives. And if you are living next door to someone who's just been dumped there, coming out of prison, or somebody who's been, it's their fifth or sixth house for antisocial behaviour, and then they're right beside you, and they're setting their fires on curtains. That's the type of stories I heard, dumping rubbish outside, music all night, and they sleep during the day. I mean, it drives you mad. It would drive anybody mad. It would drive me mad if I was living next door to someone who was doing that. So you understand people feeling like, okay, next thing they hear is Syrians are dumped there. You know, no questions asked, no consultation. And so we have to listen to people and then disentangle where the anger and the hatred comes from. Now, there's some people who are just out and out bigots and racists, you know, and there's that. But there's also people who have just been dumped upon and who feel like, you know, well, they're not sending the refugees or all these problem families to Westminster or to Chelsea, the rich areas in the UK or the rich areas in London. It's up north, out of sight, out of mind, you know. And so to try and, so in a way we were taken, you know, we were really trying to understand how did the world of 1984 and the miner strike with strong trade unions and coherent communities become the world of sorry we missed you, when people are tied to an app, you know, and every single moment of their life is controlled. There's no toilet breaks where people can work 14-hour days. How did the 8-hour day become the 14-hour day? So in a strange way, looking at what happened in the Old Oak was a way of trying to disentangle what's happened since that massive defeat, that political defeat of 1984 with the miners.
But you went out with hope. That's the thing that I think as a writer and a director, the two of you chose to do that. You didn't make a film that ends with violence and punishment. You made a film about outreach and optimism. And although there are dark elements in the Old Oak, in the narrative, the film chooses life. It chooses to find connection and force the audience to think about that too. It doesn't give you the ending. It doesn't give you the downbeat ending of The Golden Dream, which is a good ending. And it's, I think it's the only ending that film can have, where hope, you know, it is the golden cage. Hope is not what you thought it was, and the future isn't what it was promised to you. The Old Oak acknowledges all of those things, but then pushes through to something else. And it felt to me, especially after the much more downbeat endings of Daniel Blake and Sorry to Bother You, it felt to me that this was a conscious choice on yours and Ken's to go out on something that would leave people wanting a better world.
Yes, it's a very good observation. I think there's a time and a place to do tragedies. We've done tragedies in many of our films. Mm-hmm. Daniel Blake and Sorry We Missed You, I mean, they're both brutal. But you have to be faithful to the premise, and I think that's why Diego's film is also, you know, the golden dream is also faithful to the premise. But ours is faithful to the premise too, because, you know, it's all to be fought for. You know, I mean, when you look back at the miner strike, I mean, they were out for a whole year. You know, they tried to starve them back, and there was tremendous solidarity. And if the right-wing trade unions had supported them, they could have won. But within those communities, there was massive coherence, and the very fact they continued for so long, and are still, when you meet these people, there's something about them. My God, you know, they're the ones that are supporting the Palestinians now. They're the ones that are at the forefront of many, many, you know, political disputes, the many of them supporting immigrants, not all of them, I'm saying many of them. And that tradition of eating together and sticking together, you know, because they cook together. I met many of these people, and you see them, that, I mean, they were remarkable people, you know. And so, but it would have been false just to add on a false ending, you know what I mean, a happy ending, if it didn't really exist. That would have been in breach of everything we've ever done in our working lives together with Ken. But we found people like that. We found people who were cooking with the Syrians, but said we must invite the local people together. We must get them together. This is a way of fighting racism, because you sit down together and understand each other and break bread together, you'll understand people's lives. And so there's been great friendships done through that. Now, if we just made that up as a story because we wanted to tell a happy ending, that would have been a betrayal of everything we've done. But we met people like that. There's a choice to tell a tragedy. I met people who committed suicide. There were stories of great racism, but there were stories of great, you know, solidarity. And I think the basis of solidarity, first of all, is the intelligence and the imagination to put yourself in the shoes of other people. You know, so putting yourself in the shoes of the Syrians who've lost everything, but also putting your shoes on those communities that have been traumatized since 1984. You know, it's traumatized in a different type of a way, and then trying to disentangle where the anger and the fury comes from. And then the third part is the hard graft of organizing and getting people together and getting the funds together, you know, and bringing people together so they eat and they cook, and then the friendships that have been created by that. You know, so we just felt in a strange way, it's a tiny little village, but in a way the world, you know, was the palette, really. You know, we've seen the brutality of what's happened in Syria, and we've seen, you know, the brutality of what's happened with post-industrialism, communities forgotten. You know, I met some of the old miners in their 80s and 90s who were in better shape than many of the young people coming in their 30s. I mean, I'm not joking. You'd see their skin, the way they looked after themselves, mm-hmm. the hinterland of them. You went to their house, and then you go to other people who have just recently arrived, they've been dumped from other areas. Some have come out of prison. Many of them addicts, poor souls, you know, really lost souls. And you could actually just see how the world had changed and what that loss in 1984 meant. That was remarkable. That's where it was actually wandering around these villages. I kept meeting these old people who were telling me about the jazz clubs, the football teams, you know, the full lives they had. Then meeting these other people just wandering the street like zombies. You know, it was heartbreaking. So how did that become that? How did the A or D become the sorry we missed you? You know, the film, oh, there's a lovely looking dog.
Yeah, that's Winnie. Winnie, you can come inside.
We had a tough scene with our dog in the film. Yeah, you may recall.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And Dave Turner, typical Ken. Ken got him to know that dog over a four-month period, out taking him walks. I don't know how many miles they've done. Dave Turner, who played the main character, T.J. Ballantyne, for the people who haven't seen the film. And he walks a little dog called Mara. And it becomes quite a key relationship in the story. We're digressing, Norm. We're digressing. Yeah.
No. It's fine. Everything is material, right?
Yeah.
Mm. I guess usually I wrap up the podcast by asking the guest whether they've borrowed or lifted or stolen something from the film they brought in. But I think in this case, it's more the reverse, where that film, I think, leans very much on the tradition of storytelling that you and Ken Loach have been doing for all of these years. So I'm going to flip it over and ask a different question, which is, are you, now that Loach is retiring, and I'm assuming you'll keep writing, but I'm assuming that partnership was very central to the way that you worked. I mean, not the way that you worked, but to the film, the films that you wrote for Loach are very singular, I think, in terms of the other work that I've seen of yours. There's the shared vision makes, you know, you're more than the sum of your parts when you work together. Is there someone else? Is there another cinema somewhere in the world that is continuing the work that the two of you have done for all of these years? Do you see kindred spirits out there?
Well, I mean, that's a complicated question. I mean, Ken and myself, well, the way we've worked is, I mean, every relationship is its chemistry, as simple as that, and is very unique. But the way I work, you know, with Athir Boyain, the Spanish film director, you know, there's not much difference in how we work, but every, you know, we have to fall. I mean, it's a strange thing. It's a deep, deep relationship, writer-director. You know, it's a beautiful thing, and we bid very different jobs. You know, I write, Ken directs, but we meet in the middle as filmmakers. We do different things, but we're trying to be our own toughest critics. But also the wonderful thing about working with Ken, there's no big ego. We just try and just work things out. I mean, we had the most remarkable and brilliant run working with Ken. And although he won't make another, you know, feature film, you know, but, you know, we continue to do lots of work together. You know, we do lots of projects and political engagements and stuff with students. So, and that will continue, and we'll be friends till the very end. But working with Athir, you know, Athir Boyain, he's, you know, what we try to do is, you know, it's very, 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 very similar. You know, everybody's got a different sensibility. You have to find things that are, you know, work for both of us. But also, people keep asking me this question as well, where are they? I keep meeting young filmmakers who want to tell stories like we do, but I'm not sure they've had the same luck. You know, and what's been wonderful about, you know, the luck we've had with Rebecca O'Brien, our brilliant producer, is that the film's a very modest budget. They're funded from different sources, and so we take the entire responsibility for its content. Nobody's telling us what to do. And that freedom has been very, very important. It's been free, and it's been very important too for the three films I've done with Athir Boyain. Even the Rain, Yuli in Cuba, and we did a film in Spain called The Olive Tree. Mm-hmm. Oh, but I think we did it. I think we went to Even the Rain, Cambia and La Lluvia. We went to Toronto, actually. It was a wonderful experience.
That was a
very beautiful. And what was beautiful, I remember, with that was we had a tribute to my friend Howard Zinn, the historian. As soon as his name came up, there was a big, massive round of applause. So I always have great affection for the audience that goes along to that festival that Howard was held in such high esteem. But I keep on meeting brilliant young filmmakers, and I just hope they get the chance and the luck that we've had.
On behalf of the people who get to watch all the work, I hope so too. It was such a pleasure to talk to you and to see people who aren't giving up in England right now, in the UK. You can't not point to something that needs fixing.
I suppose, and we didn't talk about this, but the real difference, I think, now, Norman, big, big difference from even when me and Ken started making off films, if you just listen to the scientists, there is an end game here, you know. All of them, 95% consensus, are saying, I mean, Canada must know more than any country in the world, given what's happened to that the villages have got up in flames. But, yeah, you know, they're just saying this will happen unless, you know, we do something. Yet at the same time, we have that consensus. We've just found out, and I'm not making this up, this is the scientists and the social scientists and the economists are saying, we've never seen such an increase in the use of fossil fuels. And not only that, we've never given them a bigger subsidy. Now, what does that say about the state of mankind, really? I mean, that is really getting your head around all of those big, big questions is quite remarkable, really. You know, and I think that's where the existential crisis is. You know, it's really rushing at us. I mean, my little niece was born, my grandniece was born just a few years back, and there's a great photograph of her with her great-grand-grandniece who was 105. So there's 103 years of a difference between them. It's just one lifetime. And all the scientists are saying, this is going to happen to us in the next 100 years, one lifetime, unless we do something about it. And what are we doing? They're like ostriches. And that's kind of remarkable. And I don't know what filmmakers and storytellers do with that. It's almost, well, that's what I'm wrestling with just now, actually. Maybe if we're lucky, we might get a conversation if we're still alive.
My thanks to Paul Laverty, whose final feature collaboration with Ken Loach, The Old Oak, is now playing across North America, especially at the TIFF Lightbox in Toronto. Thanks also to Winnie Wong. She knows what she did. Paul's not on social media, but you can keep track of The Old Oak by following Photon Films Ken and Zeitgeist Films on Instagram, and you can rent or buy The Golden Dream on Google Play Movies and YouTube in North America. It's also available in the US for rental or purchase on Prime Video. You can find me on Blue Sky at Norm Wilner, and you can find this podcast there at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at someoneelsesmovie.com. The first year of the show is still available for just $20 at payhip.com/Semcast. That's the first 52 episodes of Someone Else's Movie, 44 of which aren't currently available anywhere else. And check out my newsletter, Shiny Things, at shiny-things.ghost.io. I think you'll enjoy it. Our theme song is by The Last Year. If you like it, or the show in general, please say so. Leave a review wherever you've been listening. Every little bit helps. It truly does. And check out the other shows on the Frequency Podcast Network while you're doing that. Stay safe, watch movies, wear a mask if you go out, get the new booster when you can. I'll see you next week.